Good morning, everybody. It's great to see everybody here, all your beautiful faces. Sharon, I'm glad you're feeling better. Glad to see you here. So I'm actually going to be Bobby's voice this morning because Bobby lost her voice due to a cold. So I will be reading Bobby's teaching. And the talk is on Vayeshev. The book of Genesis has repeated examples of mistaken identity, deceit, role reversals, reversals of fortunes, dreams that seem real, and reality that seems like a dream. When I first learned through my study of Buddhist teachings about impermanence and the non-existence of the self, I asked, why were these great truths not taught in the Jewish tradition? Now that I've studied some of these Buddhist texts with excellent explanations from Dharma talks by Norman Fisher and others, I find that these same truths leap out from every part of the book of Genesis. It seems obvious to me now that these fundamental wisdom teachings were always there, hiding in plain sight, in the twists and turns of the Torah narrative. Or, as Alan Liu says, on the very surface of these texts. We need only look at the storyline without even diving deeper into symbolic meanings. Ishmael is Abraham's firstborn, but the secondborn Isaac becomes the next forefather of Abraham's line. Abraham follows God's commandment to sacrifice Isaac. Until he realized he's not supposed to follow that commandment. Both Abraham and Isaac pretend that their sisters are their wives to protect themselves from being killed. God tells Rebekah, Isaac's wife, that the firstborn twin, Esau, will serve the secondborn twin, Jacob. Esau emerges first despite Jacob's grabbing Esau's heel in an attempt to emerge from the womb first. The name Jacob is translated by Everett Fox as heel sneak, heel meaning the heel of your foot, sneak. Jacob, heel sneak, tricks Esau into giving him his birthright and later masquerades as Esau to receive his older brother's blessings. Jacob has to run away to his uncle Laban to escape his brother's wrath. Laban promises Jacob his daughter Rachel and tricks him into marrying Leah. Jacob tricks Laban as he leaves with an extra share of the herd. Jacob struggles with a mysterious stranger who is not a man, not a god, in a dreamlike state that is nevertheless real enough to leave him with a hip injury and a real limp. Jacob asks for a blessing from this mysterious stranger, and when the stranger finds out that his name is Heel Sneak, he insists on giving Jacob a new name. As if to say, comments Everett Fox, you cannot be blessed with such a name as Heel Sneak. Jacob is blessed with the name Yisrael, which has been translated as God fighter, or one who wrestles with God, but can also be translated as God fights or God rules. Even after Jacob is named Yisrael, his names switch back and forth to the end of his life, reflecting the unstable, ever-changing nature of our being. Jacob later presents himself to Esau as a changed man, the father of many children and grandchildren, now walking with a limp. He behaves, says Fox, like a man who's presenting a tribute to a king. Esau, who was so degraded by Jacob in years past, is now treated with reverence. To Jacob's surprise, he receives a kiss from Esau. As we discussed last week, each letter of the word kiss has a dot above it in the Torah scroll, bringing our attention to this word. Needless to say, much commentary has been written on whether this means it was a wholehearted kiss, with wholeheartedness emphasized by the dots, or whether it's a sign that it was not heartfelt. Perhaps the dots simply remind us to pay attention to this word, to understand that a kiss can mean many different things at the same time: love, aggression, tenderness, a longing to make a connection that may or may not be genuine. And in this week's Parsha, Joseph is alive at the same time he is dead to his father. So even though the Torah does not specifically spell out an underlying philosophy that opposites coexist, that there is no thing or person with a separate solid identity, independent of the network of relationships and circumstances, our familiar Torah stories communicate in a narrative that a child can understand, teachings about impermanence, non-self, the continual emergence of everything from a complex network of relationships and circumstances. Nothing exists independently, separate from its context. Today, I would like to reflect on a few aspects of this week's Parsha from the perspective of fundamental Buddhist teachings about impermanence, non-self, and the non-existence of any specific thing separate from its network of relationships or separate from the amazing neural networks we all have from which all these phenomena emerge. Surprisingly, but not so surprisingly, what we learn about perception and cognition in our current neurobiological research aligns with the fundamental wisdom communicated in these ancient texts. Surprising, of course, because the ancients had no high-tech imaging of the complex neural network of the brain, but not surprising because the ancients spent a lot of time sitting quietly, observing what happened with their own consciousness and observing how people behave in relationships. So let's start at the beginning, Vayeshev. Now Jacob was settled in the land where his father had sojourned, Megure, where his father had been a sojourner, not a resident, the land of Canaan. Megure contains the root ger, the sojourner, one who passes through but does not reside. Indeed, we are all gerim, passing through this life, staying for a while, and not residing permanently. Jacob has a sense of being settled after surviving the dreaded encounter with his brother. He and Esau parted ways, both feeling that they had enough wealth and family and possessions so that neither needed to be jealous of the other. Being settled is a misleading way to begin the parsha because it holds out the promise of peaceful retirement, when instead this is the start of the most wrenching and heartbreaking episode of deceit in the long series of tricks that Jacob has engaged in both as the perpetrator and as the victim. No sooner has Jacob started to feel settled, to feel like he has enough, then his sense of despair, of loneliness and loss sets in with stormy adolescence of Joseph, with the stormy adolescence of Joseph. The special tunic intended as a gift of love to his favorite son only makes things worse for Joseph, deepening the resentment his brothers harbor against him. Adding insult to injury, Jacob boasts of his dreams, thinly veiled images of his brothers bowing down to him, even of his parents represented by the moon, by the sun and the moon bowing down to him. The dreams lead to further resentment as his brothers plot to get rid of him. But their plot ultimately leads Joseph on the path which makes his dreams come true. In the next chapter, we learn the story of the brother Judah's deceit. He pretends that he will give Tamar his youngest son to become the surrogate father of the deceased brother. This is what is commanded according to the Levirate tradition, in which the brother of a deceased man is obligated to marry the deceased brother's widow, to have children in the deceased brother's name. In other words, the children of that surrogate father will be considered the children of the deceased brother. Excuse me. Again, this reflects a strange confusion of identities. But since Jacob denies Tamar her right to marry the youngest son, Tamar pretends to be a sex worker, and she tricks Judah into impregnating her. She is considered righteous for posing as a prostitute and deceiving her father-in-law, because she was forcing Jacob to fulfill his traditional obligation. Joseph, meanwhile, has been lifted from the bottom of the pit and has risen to the ranks of the head of Potiphar's estate when he is deceived by Potiphar's wife, who falsely accuses him of rape. He is thrown back into prison, back into the pit, where his dream interpretation comes in handy. While the first set of dreams got him thrown into the pit, the next set get him out of the dungeon, when the Pharaoh's cupbearer remembers that Joseph was blessed with the art of dream interpretation, of predicting reality based on totally imaginary visions. Everyone in this story seems to alternate conflicting identities, the deceiver and the deceived, the victim and the perpetrator, the trickster and the tricked, the elevated and the degraded. So when it comes to identity, who can say who we really are? One might say in psychological terms that we have different parts, or that even the most righteous among us have impulses of greed and revenge that we manage to suppress or sublimate. Every Zen sit begins with confession. All my ancient twisted karma from the beginningless greed, hate, and delusion born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. We begin by owning the undesirable impulses we all have as simply human nature. Some of us have spent years in psychoanalysis to come to the same conclusion, that we all have these impulses, so we don't have to torment ourselves over being bad. And this suggests one reason why meditation and studying the Dharma or the Torah can bring greater equanimity to our lives. One of our great Zen masters, Shunryu Suzuki, taught a way of practice that was different from previous emphasis on something called enlightenment. We practice Zazen to express our true nature, not to attain enlightenment, he taught. And our true nature is neither good nor bad, deceiver or deceived, but always both at the same time without any conflict. And since nothing exists independently of other things, but only in relation to a complex web of ever-changing circumstances, whatever aspect of ourselves is manifest in each moment will depend on a myriad of other conditions. Which is why we have confusing teachings like, the self does not exist. Of course, we all exist. We are all real, and the suffering that occurs in any moment is real. And however we exist in each moment depends on a network of relationships and circumstances, so that there is no separate, solid self that exists independently of these ever-changing conditions. So Jacob is also Israel. Tamar is the trickster and the righteous woman. Joseph is elevated and degraded. And any time we try to explain this, to put this into words, the words make the concepts into beliefs that that have more rigidity than we intend. Were it to make the self into a thing, language makes this all harder to understand, but is necessary for our communication. It is hopeless to capture in words the experience of being more at peace with ever-changing, fluid, and interconnected nature of ourselves and others. So I'll turn to a great artist who paints a picture with words that captures how this type of awakening can help one find peace in turmoil. A wonderful author named Abraham Verghese describes such an experience in his book, The Covenant of Water. Rune, a very successful surgeon from Sweden, now practicing in India, considers himself happy. He lacks for nothing, has good friends, has many interests outside of medicine. Yet at the end of a long day, on his walk home, he wonders why, when he sits on a bench by the shoreline, he feels restless, unsettled. It is not about geography. He feels at home here. He hears a tapping sound and sees the shuffling figure of a person, marked with features of leprosy. The figure pauses and chants as he stands before a low-hanging moon. Verghese writes, in a dizzying shift of perspective, Rune suddenly feels he's become the leper. It's Rune who looks through scarred, opaque corneas. Rune who sees cloudy, smeared images with no edges. Rune who discerns light and shadow, but remembers what it is like to have moonlight fall on his face. Those are Rune's misshapen, ulcerated feet wrapped in bloodied gunny sack that is secured with rope. The moment passes. He has no explanation for what just happened. The sense of being momentarily embodied in another. The figure departs, swallowed by the night, the tap of a staff against stone receding. In a rush of clarity, Rune sees all the things the leper could not. The distant horizon where the sea meets sky that suspends the moon with a shawl of stars draped around it. He feels himself disappear in the capaciousness of the universe. He has become the sagging net, the blind leper who must sleep under the stars. In the immensity of the cosmos, Rune feels himself is nothing, an illusion. The difference between him and the leper is no difference at all. They are manifestations of the universal consciousness. In this new awareness, the restless chattering in his head abruptly ceases. Just as the ocean manifests as a wave or surf, but neither wave nor surf is the ocean, so also the Creator, God, or Brahma, generates an impression of a universe that takes the form of a Swedish doctor or a blind leper. Rune is real. The leper is real. The fishing net is real. Yet their separateness is an illusion. All is one. The universe is nothing but a speck of foam on a limitless ocean that is the Creator. He feels euphoric and unburdened, the peace of God which passeth all understanding. Rune goes on a monastic retreat and finds his true life's work, rehabilitating a neglected community for people who have leprosy, where he finds beauty and peace among people who appear misshapen and frightful to others. Just as Rune saw beauty where others only saw ugliness, may the beginning of Hanukkah allow us moments to experience light even in the darkness. So let's take a moment of silence before we open this up for discussion.